The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. It's the story of your life. You're moving down the
page, and you know you're on your way. Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt, the rundown is upon you on Tuesday, April the 27th, in the year of our Lord, 2021. The first story of the day, and I know you tune into or download the Hugh Hewitt Show, highly concentrated Hugh edition, because I give you the news in a hurry. And I'll come back to this story, but it's the biggest story. U.S. population over the last decade grew at the slowest rate since the 1930s, the second slowest rate on record since we began taking the census in 1790. That is terrible news for a variety of reasons, which I will cover later in the show, but that is the headline of the day. Other news, India's surging COVID virus is engulfing more and more heavily populated area. There are some cities like the giant port city of Kolkata where the rates of positivity have hit 50%. And President Biden did speak with Prime Minister Modi yesterday and promised more aid, and we are sending more aid. And that's crucial because it is simply unacceptable to have one of our crucial allies collapse and have their health infrastructure collapse this way. And so we are surging medical supplies of every sort, from oxygen forward. In the United States, easing restrictions are the story. D.C. finally is going to catch up and ease the restrictions around. But we're going to send about 60 million doses of AstraZeneca's COVID vaccine, along with other countries sending their vaccine surpluses to India, where it's simply out of control. Now, how bad was the mistake the United States health authorities made? This is why we're never going to let public health authorities make policy again, because they simply do not understand policy. The numbers on the Johnson & Johnson vaccine after the emergency halt, all the American people heard was danger, Will Robinson, danger. That's all they heard. They heard it's not safe. They didn't hear 15 cases out of 8 million. They didn't hear in the first case 7 cases out of 8 million in the first case, 3 deaths out of 8 million. No, they heard danger, 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 which is what they would have known if they knew anything about media, but public bureaucrats don't. And now fewer than 1 in 4 Americans not yet immunized. Fewer than 25% of the Americans who have not yet been immunized say they are willing to get the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Good work, CDC. Great work, FDA. I mean, just terrific work. You all should be in the world. Honest to goodness, it just makes me crazy. All that effort of Operation Warp Speed, all that effort to get a one-dose vaccine that will go around the world, and they stepped on it because they didn't get out of their cocoons and talk to anybody who knows anything about comms. Literally taking me 10 minutes to say, don't do that. Put a warning label on it. Be very specific. Say pregnant women or women between 18 and 49. Stay in touch with your doctor after you take this. Everybody else, no worries. It's great. And by the way, there really isn't any risk here. We're just being super redundantly cautious because we're pointy-headed bureaucrats and we don't ever live in the real world. Gosh, what a dumb mistake. Meanwhile, good thing, Biden administration extending free summer meal program to low-income kids. That's very good. The new census that I referred to is shifting political power south into states largely carried by Republicans in presidential elections, which bodes well for 2024 and 2028. Redistricting is already going to give the Republicans the House back in 2022 because Joe Biden is making terrible decision. And another great decision from Democrats, Senate earmarks are back. Patrick Leahy, Senator Patrick Leahy made us all very happy yesterday because he's chairman of the Appropriations Committee and he thinks he's Batman. And I don't think he's been in the same decade as I have in the last 20 years. He announced that earmarks are back. Wonderful. Tesla, I'll talk about this in the next segment when I do the market update, had record earnings at the start of a turbulent year. Markets had a wonderful day yesterday and have a wonderful week this week. Here's the good news of the morning. Looks like the Tokyo Olympics are coming. The IOC president said, look at Augusta's Masters. No problem. And Japan is continuing to plan they've got some outbreaks in Japan of the virus, so they're a little bit worried. But the good news is, looks like it's going to happen, and we all need the Olympics. Bad news, Netanyahu and Gantz, the security cabinet, along with the prime minister and the defense minister in Israel, have authorized broad military action if the Gaza crazies continue to throw rockets, war crimes, actually. It's just a war crime to throw rockets at civilians. And they've got the tanks lined up, and Gaza's going to get hit hard if they don't stop this nuts. Meanwhile, testing Biden, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard are swarming U.S. Coast Guard vessels in the Persian Gulf with their little, you know, Trump would have blown them out of the water. Joe Biden saying, come on board, you know, we'll see what he says. Other good news, California Governor Gavin Newsom is going to face a near-certain recall. It's almost a done deal because they've already verified 1.63 million signatures. That's well above the 1.49 million necessary. So there's going to be a recall. The question is whether the when will the Democrats cheat? When will they try and move around the actual date of the recall, which in my view ought to be tomorrow, right? If you voted for a recall and you're the sovereign people of California and it's in your state constitution, they ought to schedule it in 6 weeks and hold it. But they'll try and push it off for a year and a half to let Gavin recover. Not a bad guy. He's a nice guy. It's just that California's in collapse. Meanwhile, at the Oscars, you know, I didn't watch it. I'm going to play for you Tyler Perry a little bit later because he gave a good speech. I didn't know that Frances McDormand asked the key question. And I read it last night and I'm going to tell you, please watch our movie on the largest screen possible. That's what she asked everyone. Please watch our movie on the largest screen possible. If that isn't ever a cry for help from a nice lady who's a wonderful actress, that's a cry for help. Actors realize very, very quickly they're going back to the studio system. They're getting sucked into Amazon and Netflix and Disney. They're just all, if you can't get something streaming, you're deader and deader and deader. Now, AMC reopened. I went to the movies this weekend, saw the terrible Mortal Kombat, but my boys are both in town. I was able to go with them, and they, you know, I spent most of their young adulthood yelling, turn it off or turn it down at them when they were playing video games. So we went and we saw it, and now I'm very, very confident that my parenting was good because they couldn't remember any of it. I didn't let them watch too much of it. There are a couple of things that ring through. Like, now I own your soul and stuff. But other than that, I'm feeling pretty good. Simon & Schuster. I've told people I'm not writing any more books. I have one, maybe more book I'm thinking about writing, but it's not political. Simon & Schuster, which was my last publisher, great publisher. Jonathan Karp is a great... Jonathan, you call me if you want my last book. He's a great editor-in-chief. Simon & Schuster employees submit petition demanding no deals with Trump administration authors. So you see, this skips a whole step in the book burning process. So all the woke people, it's only 216 international signatures, several thousand internal, 216 internal people, several thousand outside supporters who don't matter, and they're the woke people. But we got 216 people who want to skip a step in the book burning. And the whole point of book burning is to make sure there are no books that offend you. And it's widely used in authoritarian, totalitarian regimes, but it's not really popular here in America. And the 216 employees at Simon & Schuster in the book burning business. Then the strangest story of the day. I did not know this was going on. In Great Britain, there is an IRA commander trial. Not of the IRA commander, but two paratroopers from the Troubles are on trial for the death of an IRA commander, a guy named Joe McCann, who was shot and killed by the British Army in April of 1972. And the two former British soldiers, who are now in their 70s, went on trial on Monday, accused of his murder. Now, you ask me, does this serve anybody's interests? 72 to 82, 92, 2002, 2012. So we're 50 years ago. And I did 49 years ago. It is alleged that an IRA killer, an IRA commander who allegedly killed 15 British soldiers by the time he was shot dead, was wrongly killed by two British paratroopers. And for those of us who are as old enough, you know, I'm 65, so I can remember this. And my son's mother-in-law is an Irish woman, by an American now, by way of Canada, and she remembers the Troubles, and she's told me about it, and I'll have to get her opinion. I don't know what good this serves anybody in Ireland, in Northern Ireland, in the United Kingdom, in Great Britain, to go back 50 years to find out whether or not the British paratroopers are guilty of shooting. I mean, it's just, why don't we all uncork the troubles again? Because if you don't have any memory of this, and Dwayne's not even old enough to have any memory of this, and certainly not Adam and not Harley and Ben. It was awful. It was terrible. It was just terrible. Be like going back to the India-Pakistan fiasco of 1948 and say, let's find some people to put on trial who are in their 90s. Because that's really, when we separated India, partitioned India, you know, 2 million people died in violent deaths. I don't get it. I don't understand it, but it's a story, so it's in the rundown. You can download the rundown every day at Hugh Hewitt Show podcast. Highly concentrated Hugh, the rundown plus the interviews I do are all available at interviewwithhugh.com, including the interview with Hugh yesterday with Terry Pluto. Coming right back, America. Stay tuned. Is this where the story ends, America? It's Hugh Hewitt. I told you at the beginning of today's show that the most important news story of the day yesterday is one that is likely to pass by without much reflection. I want to go back to the New York Times story by Sabrina Taxerwise and Robert Gebeloff. U.S. population over the last decade grew at the slowest rate since the 1930s. Over the past decade, the United States population grew at the second slowest rate since the government started counting in 1790. The Census Bureau reported yesterday a remarkable slackening that was driven by a slowdown in immigration and a declining birth rate. The Bureau also reports changes to the political map, blah, blah, blah. And we all know Republicans won, Democrats lost. The South won, the Northeast lost, and the Midwest lost. And, you know, that doesn't matter. What matters is not the shifting political power, because demographics change, people's priorities change. The long view is you can't tell what's going to happen at the next presidential election, much less five down the road. But you can tell what happens to national greatness and to American prosperity by virtue of the fact you need to grow. There needs to be more people. Don't listen to the left wingers who say we've got too many people. We've got 330 million people. It's nothing compared to China, India combined. They have 2.6 billion people. Right, so we're like eight times behind China, India combined. Here are three paragraphs. The lower birth rate combined with the decline in inflows of immigration and shifting age demographics, there are now more Americans 80 and older than two or younger. Oops, that's not the way it's supposed to be. The Bible says man is given 3 score and 10, and we've improved on that, right? We got 4 scores now, and it's great that there are more Americans living longer. I'm not at all upset about people beyond 80. Goodness, no, I'd like to make my grandfather's 101. But that more are older than 80 than younger than 2 means the United States may be entering an era of substantially lower population growth. That would put the United States in line with the countries of Europe. Oops, no, we don't want to die off. And East Asia, oops, no, we don't want to die off. This is a big deal, said Ronald Lee, a demographer who founded the Center on Economics and Demography of Aging at the University of California, Berkeley, noting that the United States has long outpaced other developed countries in population. If it stays lower like this, it means the end of American exceptionalism in this regard. It means the end of a lot of things. You know, at a very, very basic level, you got to have people to work. You got to have people to produce and invent. You have to have people taking the algebra classes that will no longer be offered to anyone below ninth grade in Virginia if the crazy left-wingers in Richmond Avenue. So you got to have people to excel and to thrive, and you got to have people to work jobs that need working. You need people. And in the age of artificial intelligence, every person is a little data output. If you understand anything about AI, now I don't want to capture people's data without their consent. I think surveillance capitalism is evil, and surveillance totalitarianism, like in the Chinese Communist Party's vision of dystopian excellence, is even worse than evil. It's not human. But artificial intelligence depends upon data, and data freely given and appropriately privatized and kept safe will drive the AI economy. And if we don't have people producing data, we will fall further and further behind in the accumulation of national data sets that tell us about this world. But we will also not have anyone to put me out in the sun when I'm 100, and which that's what I'm really worried about. In 35 years, I've got the 3 grandkids already, but I need a few more spares, someone to come say hello and put me out in the sun for a while. And believe you me, before you know it and turn around, you'll be retired and wondering, where are all the people? Because they're not going to be around. Now, this is not my problem. This is your problem if you're 40 and 30. And I'm always amazed by the demographics of this audience. 1-800-520-1234. Does this alarm you? You've got to go have babies. You people under 40, go have your babies. You people under 30, this country needs babies. We need immigration. People who are complaining about immigration at the southern border, yeah, it's crazy. It's not the way we want to do it. We want to put up the fence. We want to orderly invite people from abroad. We want to have the best and the brightest. We want to have the smartest. We want to have refugees, people in economic need, people who fear for their lives. We want a merit-based system, the cotton system. We want the Australia system is the cotton system. But we need immigration. More importantly, we need Americans to have children. If you're pregnant right now, thank you. And I think maybe the millennials don't understand this. Catholics do. Catholics have always understood this, that the whole purpose of life is to continue life. And some people can't have children or don't get married and pursue a religious vocation, and that's fine. That's part of the plan. That's always been that way. Some people serve different purposes. But the number one purpose is to know, love, and serve God, and you can't do that unless you're alive. Now, a little Baltimore catechism coming your way there, friends. Number one reason we are alive and created is to know, love, and serve God. And that means, in most cases, producing children who can do the same thing. So this is a pro-kids radio show. And it's a pro, my friend Al Mohler, who runs the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and Boyce College, one of the great colleges in America, used to tell me that his students actually don't have intimate relations until they get married, and then that's all they do. And they produce like 7, 8, 9 children. And that's great. It doesn't have to be just the Mormons and the Catholics. The evangelicals can get on this. You dystopian, black-shirted Antifa people. The joy of a family is far greater than breaking a window. Has anyone told you that? Spray painting the local monument. There's not a lot of upside in that. There's really not a lot of satisfaction. I don't know what you're getting out of it. Better to find the man or woman of your dreams at the right age and go forth and have children and put up with the sleepless nights, because then when you're my age and you don't have to do any work at all unless you want to, because you're out of the game and you're playing with the kids and you're taking them to ice cream before dinner, which is what I'm known for among my grandchildren, ice cream before dinner, which is as it should be. Gramps used to take me down when the parents weren't looking, and we'd go to the corner store and buy root beer barrels, which were, that's why I had cavity after cavity, is because I saw my grandpa a lot, and he didn't give a damn. He wasn't going to care what Nurse Marguerite had to say or Attorney Bill. So that's what grandparents are for, but that's what I'm in. I'm in the zone. When I'm young enough to run a half marathon and old enough to not care what my kids say about their kids. That's the zone. That's what you work your whole life for. And I'm here telling you, you got to pick up the pace, Americans. This is unacceptable. Young people, this is unacceptable. Our nation is screwed. Your future is screwed. Your children, if you had one, you're sitting there looking at one kid and saying, I did really good. I had my one baby. No, you need 2.3. That is the status quo ante, and we need more than that. Have you looked at this country? There's plenty of room in this country. Honest to goodness, I would stand at the border, and I'd let anyone in who had tools and give them a ticket to Detroit and one of the rundown homes or tenements in Detroit and say, go take that. It's yours. Rebuild it. You show up with a hammer and a toolbox, I'll send you to Detroit or any of the other metropolitan areas that have emptied out and are falling apart. But we got to pick up the pace on this. This is not, except first time since the 1930s that we have the slowest rate. We didn't go backwards. We barely grew. The population grew at the second slowest rate since the government started counting in 1790. Does that not alarm you? 1-800-520-1234. That should worry you. There's a reason why all those parochial schools are closing and shouldn't close. It's because the Catholics, I don't know, they bought into the idea that two children was the right number. All that 60s propaganda, what was the greening of the, you know, the big greening book that came out in the 70s that everyone read and it was wrong. Every Malthus that comes along every 25 years, it says we got too many people. Look at the planet. We don't have too many people. We have too many undereducated people, too many ill-fed people, too many people who are illiterate. That's not that. The problem is not too many people. It's too many people in those subcategories. And in America, we need people. We need babies and immigration inflow. And don't let anyone tell you otherwise, or we're going to get wiped out. I don't mean wiped out genocidally. I mean we're just going to be a footnote. 1,000 years from now, there was once this bright, shining city on a hill, and they decided not to have babies. That's what's going to happen. The bright, shining city on a hill. Apparently, we're not answering the phone today. Ben and Harley are working. They don't care that the phones are ringing. And I'm telling you right now, I'm going to do relief factors so they can actually screen a call. And I can take it, because all these people want to talk to me about it, and they're not talking. ReliefFactor.com. I'm going to take it early. Got my three in yesterday after a great week last week. Longer run today. Back in recovery mode. Why? Because ReliefFactor.com works. I'm Jerry every morning. I carry in Kirkham and Resveratrol and Omega. Why do I do that? Why do I do that? Because I want to be out there exercising every day. Activity is what, in fact, drives your ability to thrive. You don't have to be Arnold in the gym. You don't have to be the person who is the fastest person on the go-kart path. No. You don't have to be bicycling. In fact, you're a menace if you do bicycle too fast on the path. But you do need to take your relieffactor.com so you can get out there and be in the game. Get out there, be in the game. Relieffactor.com makes it possible. I really need you to take it and to try it. Tens of thousands of people join me every morning. Jim in San Antonio, listening on K-Loop. Good morning, Jim. What do you think?
Hey, good morning, Hugh. Love your show. Look, you're dead on the money. There is room for a lot more people. The problem is the way that the left, the Democrats, have gone about doing it is completely reckless, irresponsible, out of control. They had no plan. They just said, pour in here. No plan for housing, no plan for food, no plan for medical care. And they can't take care of the 2 million homeless people we've got in our country right now, but suddenly we're going to take care of, you know, millions more flooding across the border. It's insanity. Absolutely.
Well, we could actually do millions more if you allowed the private sector to figure it out. You turned it over to Catholic charities. The most interesting thing I read in the book about immigration was that when you allow George W. Bush's new book on immigrants, is the most effective groups in the world are the U.S. Conference of the Catholic Bishops and Catholic Charities at bringing refugees from all over the world and giving them places and getting them sponsorships and taking care of them and watching them flourish. We can do that. The mob at the border is not the way to do it, Jim. And you're living the life of
it, right?
Down in San Antonio. So we just have to get serious. The cotton system is the way to go. Thank you, my friend. 1-800-520-1234. I'm not advocating open borders. No, that does not make any sense. I'm advocating robust population growth that includes having more babies in the United States, and it includes, most definitely, it includes refugee resettlement. It includes aggressive immigration of people based on merit. It includes some family separation, not what we do now, which is mindless. It includes all that, but we cannot continue to do that. David Drucker is next. We'll look at the political implications of the census, but keep calling in 1-800-520-1234. And you millennials, we need some babies, lots of them. Stay tuned. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Portions of the Hugh Hewitt Show are brought to you by Job Creators Network.
Well, Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, joined by David Drucker of the Washington Examiner. You also see him all over cable. Good morning, David. How are you?
I'm great, Hugh. Good morning.
The census came out yesterday, and we've got a little less change than we expected. Texas picked up two. A few states got one. A few states lost one, but there were no triple plays. Generally speaking, what's the impact politically?
Well, look, I still think that it's a potential net positive for Republicans, just given where the seats are migrating to, Texas, Florida. You could argue that losing seats in Ohio and Pennsylvania theoretically could hurt Republicans. But at the end of the day, you know, I still think 2022 is governed by the fact that Nancy Pelosi has a 4 or 5 seat majority. It's not a governing majority. And when you look at historically the number of seats, the out party from the White House picks up in a midterm election, Republicans are in good shape. But this will certainly help matters because, you know, you look at those 5 seats and the way things move around, even though Democrats will be able to do some damage themselves, possibly eliminating Republican seats in New York and Illinois and elsewhere, I think Republicans are in a position to make those up and maybe end up 1 or 2 seats ahead.
My math, back of the envelope math, was just based on where the seats went. It's a net 3 Republicans because Texas and Florida both get one. Texas gets 2, Florida gets 1. Those are 3 pickups. Ohio loses one. They're going to X out one of the 2 Democrats. But Illinois loses one. They'll kill a Republican. Michigan, all the other places are independent commissions like Colorado, Montana. They both pick up a state. I don't know how Colorado and Montana don't help the Republicans. They're both independent commissions, but Oregon is a blue state. So I had it, and North Carolina is divided. So I had it as a net 1 pickup, a net 3 to 4 pickup for the Republicans, just on the basis of where they went. Am I in the ballpark?
Yeah, I think you're in the ballpark. I mean, I think when you look at where things are moving around and you know, how the districts are apportioned, which is a key point you brought up. It's not just where they're going, but who's in charge of drawing them. I don't think there's any scenario for how this makes it any tougher for Republicans. In talking to Republican and Democratic operatives who focus on redistricting this year, what they told me was that this may not be, and Republicans believe this too, it may not be some sort of bonanza for Republicans, but nobody believed that they were going to end up worse off. And so you're going from anywhere from standing pat, which I think is unlikely, to a net gain of a few seats before the first votes of the midterms are even held.
Yeah, and you look at the states where Democrats run everything, and it's Massachusetts, Rhode Island, Connecticut, Maryland, Illinois, New Mexico, Nevada, and Oregon. They've already screwed the Republicans as much as they can be screwed. I really do think that. Republicans are kind of late. This will make my Democratic listeners crazy. Republicans are late to the ruthless game, right? Democrats invented gerrymandering. They know how to do it. They did it to a science, the Daily Machine, et cetera. But now Republicans are pretty wise. The only thing you cannot do is use race. If you use race, the maps will be thrown out, and you'll end up with a judge-drawn thing. So they're smarter than that now. And this has become, I don't know, do you know anyone in this business, David? There's a business out there on how to draw these lines without
It's insane in that, you know, technology has made it so that you can fine-tune these maps such that you could put one house into one district and put their next-door neighbor into another district. It's really amazing. And Republicans, to your point, have gotten so much better at it in this way. I think Republican map drawers have always existed, and they were always pretty good. But the Republican infrastructure surrounding redistricting is now a lot better. And Republicans have a political group which is filled with a number of strategists and some lawyers, and they now have a legal network throughout the country where they're prepared to go to court on a moment's notice to do battle with Democrats over these districts and in these lawsuits surrounding redistricting, which we will begin to see as of today.
And this, you know what else they've got, David?
Years ago, Republicans didn't have.
They got screwed by the alleged independent commissions of 10 years ago. The one in Arizona was particularly bent out of shape by Democrats who had gamed it. And Doug Ducey and Mark Brnovich, the governor and attorney general, respectively, they haven't gamed it, but they've made sure that its membership is going to do what it's supposed to do, which is draw, you know, right angles instead of create. They took Ben Quayle and, you know, the allegedly independent district. They threw him in with Dave, whatever his name is, and they had a knife fight primary, and Ben Quayle left politics. That's not going to happen this time. There's not going to. And that was a block deal. That was one of the things you just referenced. They changed it by a block. We're much better at this than we were 10 years ago.
Look, I think these independent commissions sound good, and they don't tend to actually produce independent districts. I mean, the only place where I've seen it work the way it's really people would think it's supposed to work is Iowa. It's probably because it's like a square, and you can just divide it into quarters.
I think it works in Minnesota. I think it's going to work in Minnesota because those people are all Lutherans.
It may be, but at the end of the day, there's something to be said for politicians who are accountable to voters drawing these things. And if people don't like it, they can throw them out.
That's constitutional, too. It has the additional benefit of being constitutional. David M. Drucker on Twitter, always following the bigger stories. Good to talk to you. Don't go anywhere, America. 1-800-520-1234. Brad, surely don't go anywhere. I'll get to you on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Morning, glory, America. Bonjour, hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. On a beautiful spring day, it looks like it's going to be gorgeous. Byron York is also in the Beltway. And Byron, this is the week that we live for, right? It's before the cicadas come and it's warm.
The cicadas, you know, I am a person in Washington who remembers the last time the cicadas were here 17 years ago. And I have to tell you, it was so weird. It was like living in a 1950s science fiction movie. It was just this loud buzz everywhere you went, every day, every moment. Really,
I wasn't here for that. I was here 34 years ago in Reagan.
No.
And yeah, and you step on them on
the Reagan cicadas.
I was here for the Reagan cicadas, and you step on them everywhere, and they run. They were called clumsy flyers. They're not clumsy flyers. They drop like pellets from the sky on your clothes. It's terrible. But let us not. Most people will not be sympathetic. Byron, you wrote about immigration this week, and I want to go back and talk with you a little bit. The biggest story of the day, though it won't be recognized, is actually the census. And the census comes out not for political reasons, not because the Republicans get a marginal advantage, blah, 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 but because this is the lowest population growth since the 1930s and the second lowest since we began taking the census in 1790. It's a population crisis. If we do not grow, we will not endure. This is a basic demographic fact. China and India will just eat our lunch in the age of artificial intelligence and innovation and invention. What are we going to do about that? We got to let more people in this country in a smart way.
Well, just so people know, the population of the United States, census measured in 2010, was 308,745,538. And the population of the United States, as measured by the 2020 census, is 331,449,281. So it has grown by 22.7 million people in that 10-year period. That's 7.4%. It is the lowest rate over a 10-year period that has the second lowest rate that has been measured. But it is not nothing. It is still 7.4% over that 10-year period. Now, on the immigration part, I was interesting. I was listening to you before, so I start going to my charts, and I go to the Homeland Security's annual the Yearbook of Immigration, which I would recommend to everybody. It's a fantastic document, tons and tons of stuff. Looking at the green cards that the United States grants every year, that is lawful permanent resident status. If you get one, you're in. You can stay in for all of your life. You can become a citizen. The number that we've granted has been very stable for the last 20 years or so, which is about a million a year. As a matter of fact, that we granted about a million a year green cards every year, except 2013, and I think that economic conditions at that point played a role in it, since 2005. And they did significantly more green cards, for example, than were given in the 90s or in the 80s during the Reagan period. And all I would say is that's not nothing. That's a significant amount of immigration, of making Americans, creating new Americans. It stayed high during the Trump years because Trump did focus on illegal immigration. So I think the situation is not as bad as you, not as dire.
Okay, let me try and explain it to you this way, or to the audience this way. You'll get it. If you are a new entrepreneur and you're setting up business and you have $330,000 to begin your business, and you're in the same space as two other competitors who have not $330,000, but $130,000. I'm hoping I'm getting the math here. Well, I mean, 1,300,000. So China and India have 1.3 billion people. We've got 330,000. We are competing in artificial intelligence, innovation, education, and invention with two superpowers of population. And we are getting our lunches handed to us, Byron. As a purely American exceptionalist who wants to endure and prosper, we need to let in. It's not nothing. I agree. It's a million people a year. That's great. We need 5, 7, 10 million people a year. And the country's got plenty of space for them, especially if they come in under the cotton system based on talent and drive and capital. And I mean, we got to bring people in or we're going to get our you know, we're going to be toast.
So China has always, in terms of population, has always been bigger than the United States, right?
Correct, but they have never had capitalism
now,
at
what point did population become the key to its economic progress in history when it wasn't before?
When they took on socialism with capitalist characteristics, China with, when they began to say capitalism with Chinese characteristics, that's when it mattered. Population matters to capitalism. It is the fundamental driver of capitalism growth. And when India and China embraced free markets, their population advantage began to kick in. That's why China has closed the gap by some metrics to equality and by all metrics within 10 years beyond us, because they have embraced capitalism with Chinese characteristics. It's not freedom. Don't get me wrong. It's not freedom, but it is capitalism, and it works with people.
And how do we get to a 5-7 million green cards a year?
I'm going to ask Cotton that. I believe you throw your doors open. I believe that you throw your doors open in the consulates of the world and say, we'll take your tired and your poor over the southern border and we'll figure that out. But we want your smart people who want an education. We don't want people who are working for the state shut down, basically PRC, inward immigration. We want Indians and Indonesians, and we want Russians who want to get the hell out of that country. We want Europeans who are tired of bureaucrats. Bring us your entrepreneurs and your hard workers. And, you know, the Hewitt theory about Detroit is give everyone with a toolbox one of the abandoned houses in Detroit and let them go rebuild the city. I mean, it's not really that hard to find people who want to work.
Well, one of the weird things about the Biden administration was what the president did, President Biden did, about refugees. President Trump had lowered the number of refugees admitted per year, and Biden was widely expected to raise it, and then he didn't. And then there was such a brouhaha that within hours, he announced he would, in fact, raise it. But the weird thing is that the refugee system is a system in which someone overseas who wants refugee status in the United States applies for it overseas, and the United States government can evaluate that claim and then decide to let him in or not. In other words, it gives the United States control over who comes into the country. In other words, that's a good thing.
Yes.
The bad thing is a large horde, a surge of people crossing the United States-Mexico border illegally, and then the Biden administration saying, oh, it's okay, you can stay. So he minimized the good thing, and he's maximized the bad thing. And
yeah, the refugee decision.
It's a bizarre situation.
Yeah, the refugee decision. Donald Trump was pretty generous on refugees until the last year when COVID broke out. And there's been some bad reporting that Trump was terrible on refugees. He's actually pretty good on refugees until COVID broke out when we had to shut everything down. Now we've figured out that you can inoculate people, vaccinate people, and let them in. And Joe Biden ought to be aggressively allowing refugees in, especially based on merit. Byron, it just frustrates me. It's not really that difficult a problem, except that the extremes in America polarize it. And the southern border is a mess, and that's not the way to do it. I mean, come all in free is not the way to do it. And they don't get health checks, and they don't get vaccinations, and they don't get education, and they don't get sponsorships. But that doesn't have to be the way we've done it Ellis Island style over the generations of America when we filled the continent up.
Well, look, there has always been an immigration deal just sitting out there, which is legalize more people in the United States and legalize the arrival of more people if you stop the flow of illegal immigration on the southern border.
That's it in a nutshell. Yep.
And neither side will go for it. Neither side will go for it because Democrats will not accept actual physical security at the southern border. And Republicans no longer believe Democrats when they say they will accept.
You have hit the nub of the problem. I believe the carrot that breaks it is regularization for the 14 to 20 million people who are here, save those who are under indictment, convicted, or a person
the
of
deal
interest.
That Trump could have taken.
Trump could have taken it. He didn't.
Gave him DACA.
Yeah, Trump didn't take it. It was the biggest mistake of his term. But we can take it now. I'm going to talk with Cotton about it. We can take it now. And not just DACA. I'm talking the whole shebang. Make it so an offer they can't refuse. Byron York is a must-read. Follow him on Twitter. Follow me to the next segment, America.
Portions of the Hugh Hewitt Show are brought to you by Job Creators Network.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt. That music means I'm joined by Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy. Hey, Admiral, good morning. How are you?
Doing great, Hugh. How are you?
I'm terrific. I see 2034 behind you still on bestseller lists as people turn their eyes towards China and wonder what's ahead. Congratulations. Keeping a novel on those lists this long is really something. It's spreading. I'm sure you're very pleased with that.
I am, and two comments. One is any number of my very senior friends who are retired military, retired ambassadors say, hey, Jim, you wrote a great book, but you got one big thing wrong, the date. They feel, many of them, that this is a looming tower that is much closer than 2034, and there's something to be said about that. And that's my second point, which is, yeah, it's on the New York Times fiction bestseller list. Let's keep it on the fiction side.
On the fiction side. And reading it is actually one of the ways to do that. That's why I love the work of Daniel Silva and others who write thrillers that educate. Let me turn to three stories. The first one is just awful. The wreck of the KRI Nanggala 402, the Indonesian submarine, 53 sailors are dead. They recognized it. They've got the debris. They were loading torpedo tubes at the time they lost contact, Admiral. Now, when you were running Southern Command and NATO, you had a lot of submarines in your control. It wasn't your calling, but I know you must know a lot in the submarine community. How dangerous is it what they were doing at the time that this happened, to this tragedy? And it's an ally, right? It's an allied Navy. What happened?
Yeah, first of all, good point to be made here is that these are diesel submarines, the one that went down. The submarines that the U.S. Navy operates are nuclear powered. As a result of being nuclear powered, they are much stronger structurally because they have to be, because there's a nuclear reactor inside them. So a diesel boat, and this was a fairly old diesel boat, they're just a little less solidly constructed. They're made to operate in shallower water. They're not designed to go super deep the way our nukes are. And yes, one of the vulnerable things you do, if you think about it, is torpedo tubes, because at some point, if you're going to launch a torpedo out of a submarine, you have to open it up to the ocean. So it's a delicate operation, and sometimes things go wrong. It's a tragic event. All mariners feel it. And let's face it, it's an awful way to die. If viewers want to get a better sense of what it's like in a diesel boat, I'm sure, Hugh, you've seen the really remarkable film Das Boot, The Boat, yes, about the German U-boat. Things have changed a lot on diesel submarines since then, but the basic sense of being in a very small, very confined space, and in that film, watching what happens will give you a sense of what the final moments for this tragically lost crew must have been like.
You know, I visited, I can't remember the name, I think it might be the Finn. There's a submarine from World War II berthed permanently at Hawaii at Pearl Harbor, on which I went just to get a sense of what a World War II submariner lived with. And boy, welcome to your coffin that you're going to float in for the next year and a half underwater. It's just as, I couldn't have done it. I'd have gone crazy. I don't even like MRIs.
But the point I'll make there is that the submarine force had the highest level of casualties on a percentage basis than any other force in the U.S. military in the Second World War.
I did not know that.
Percentage of the force. It was the riskiest duty you could take. And also, if you look at percentage of medals of honor, Navy crosses, for enormously heroic acts, you really got to hand it to, as they call themselves, the silent service. I like to refer to these days as a Navy destroyer officer. We refer to them as targets, but they have the same expression for us. But listen, let me tell you, in all seriousness, even if I strapped on the most modern, deadly destroyer, anti-submarine destroyer, that would be one of our Arleigh Burkes, I'm not sure I'd want to tangle with a U.S.-trained nuclear submarine. Those folks are pretty damn good down under.
Let's get more of them. This brings me to my second subject. Our friend Jerry Hendricks wrote for the Wall Street Journal about infrastructure and shipbuilding. I want to take it a step further. Tomorrow I'm going to have Washington Post writer Joby Warrick on. He's written this new book called Red Line. And in this book is a story within a story about the USS, what was it called? The Ray. It's from the Cape Ray. The USS Reserve Fleet takes the Cape Ray out of mothballs and turns it into a chemical weapons disposal factory. It's truly one of the most extraordinary innovation stories I've ever read. I didn't know anything about it. I don't know if you were running NATO at the time, but are you acquainted with what we did with the Cape Ray and how we did it?
Not in great depth, Hugh, but I'm a big fan of Joby Warrick. He wrote a Pulitzer Prize winning book several years ago about, it's called Black Flags, about the rise of ISIS, if you really want to understand the rise of ISIS. So if someone who is as good a reporter as Toby is going to dive into something like that, I'm going to reserve judgment till I actually read the book, and I'll make some comments when I have read it, because he's a terrific writer, and it is a fascinating story.
It's called Red Line, Red Line, Red Line. That's all people have to end. The last name is Warrick, W-A-R-R-I-C-K, Warrick, and Red Line will get you there, and I'll talk to him tomorrow. So, Admiral, it leads me to this. They pulled it out of the reserve fleet. So I called up Captain Hendricks, and I said, how ready is the ready reserve? And he said, it's not very ready. And it gets worse every year. It's like our maritime capacity. What's your assessment of the ready reserve? And this is the maritime fleet. This is one of these roll on and go. I don't know what they call them. There's a term for them. They're just giant container ships that can move everything. And he said, yeah, they're berthed, but they're not ready to go. Do you share that dim view?
I do, although it varies, and Jerry would know this well and would say the same thing. It's one thing to talk about, say, a destroyer, a high-end combat ship that's in mothballs, as the saying goes. Those will take a considerable amount of time to pull out, to get all those electronics back up to speed, to get the connectivity restored, to do all of the end-to-end communications testing. Very difficult. Months, if not a year plus, to get them ready to go in at the most basic level in combat. At the other end are what you're referring to, the big, they're called ro-ros, roll That's on, it. Roll off. Yeah, it just means it's an obvious term for you roll stock, big platforms, tanks even, on and off. And so those are relatively simple platforms, and they can be brought back up to speed, I would say, in months. But it varies. None of them are like, you know, cars in the parking lot at a used car dealership where you just go out, put the key in and drive it away. It will take months to, in some cases, a year or more to get these ships ready to go. So let me make a point about this, which is another important event today. We talk about the size of the U.S. fleet. Guess who deployed a carrier strike group today? The BRICS. The American 65,000 ton aircraft carrier, air wing of about 40 aircraft, including the F-35 Lightning. This is a carrier strike group centered around Queen Elizabeth. Two of their very high-end anti-air destroyers, equally capable almost to our Aegis ships. Two of their absolutely high-end anti-submarine warfare ships. Two auxiliaries, so a real carrier strike group. We deployed a destroyer with it, and the Dutch deployed a frigate with it. So my point is, yeah, the Ready Reserve ain't ready, but our allies are ready. And where is that carrier strike group going, Q? It's going to hit one of the South China Sea and the Indian Ocean. It's going to hit 40 countries and be very much a part of our allies saying to China, we stand with the United States. That, I think, is the deployment of the day.
That is a great bit of news. I had one other story to bring up to you, which is this week, Israel launched its first new generation of missile boat. Now, people don't think of Israel as being a maritime power, but they've got to protect their coast. They've got to protect their natural gas fields. And this missile boat is small, but it carries quite a punch. And I'm wondering, is that the wave of the future? If the Chinese are threatening, as we see in 2034, to bury our carriers under a hailstorm of missiles, don't you just replicate a whole bunch, a swarm of these missile boats on the size that Israel has and put them in Japan and friendlier places, and boom, you've got a deterrent to the deterrent?
Yeah, indeed. And by the way, let's add to the concern by saying that increasingly, they'll be armed not with, if you will, conventional surface-to-surface missiles, but what are called hypersonics, which move at five times the speed of sound. A conventional one goes about the speed of sound. So this is a very significant threat. And by the way, it's not just Israel and not just China. Iran is very big in this game. We just saw Iranian Revolutionary Guard warships, very small, very fast, swarming a U.S. Coast Guard cutter in the Arabian Gulf. So, yes, a significant part of combat power in the littorals by Israel, Iran, but also by great powers, by China inside that first island chain, is going to be these fast patrol boats. So what do we counter with, I think, is the question. This is part of where the Commandant of the Marine Corps, General Berger, David Berger, who I've spoken with you about before, who is one of the premier thinkers we've got right now on active duty, is talking about using Marines in a very lethal way. That will be one of the threats they would seek to neutralize.
Last question, Admiral. When we talk about these small boats, does the United States have a counterpart to them? Do we build anything like the Israelis and the Iranians?
We do not. And I personally think it is well worth exploring. The other thing we don't build is where we started this conversation, are diesel submarines. And, you know, I spoke earlier about their limitations, but in the littorals, because they're very quiet, they're battery operated, they're much, much, much less expensive than the nuclear attack boats. I think you can make a case for a mix of a small number of diesels built by ourselves, but really the people who build great diesel boats are the Germans, the Japanese, the Australians, the French, because they've been doing it since the end of World War II, and we focused on nuclear power boats. So diesel submarines we don't do, and patrol boats we don't do. When I first came on active duty in 1976, otherwise known as 1.2 million years ago, we did operate a small fleet of fast missile boats, and they were home ported in Key West, Florida. Do you think that
good
was
duty?
That was a fun part of the Navy. Unfortunately, we decommissioned those. I think looking at small boat, high punch offense, and I think diesels are both worth a look. Not sure we'd land there and actually build them, but we ought to study that and take a look. That'd be a good question for your friend Jerry Hendricks.
Admiral James Stavridis, always a pleasure. The author of 2034 best-selling book on the New York Times list. Talk to you next week, Admiral. You're looking good. Thank you for joining me per usual. Always a great conversation. Also per usual. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Job Creators Network is a great sponsor of our show, and I've been working with them for years, and they made a very smart hire recently. Patrick Pizzella joined the Job Creators Network team. I want you to go to joinjcn.com because we need small business to be represented inside of the United States, and Patrick and I are going to talk about one reason why, but I really do want you to go to joinjcn right now, joinjcn.com. Good morning, Patrick. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Doing great.
You and I are old guys. We go back to Reagan. You're the only guy I know who actually served all of Bush, all of Trump, and some of Obama. Am I right about that?
You're right, Hugh.
You know, honest to goodness, I know people who did all of Bush, and I know people who did all of Trump. I know very few people who did both. Robert O'Brien did both, and I don't know any of them who did Obama. How did you end up working under Obama, Patrick Pizzella, before you joined the Job Creators Network?
Well, I, as you know, the Senate negotiates with the White House on the makeup of independent regulatory bodies, and the Senate minority leader at the time, McConnell, put my name forth to the Obama White House to be a member of the Federal Labor Relations Authority, and the Obama White House said, okay, and I was confirmed.
Well, you know, the leader McConnell's a pretty smart guy, so he got a winner here. Now, we got to talk about the PRO Act, but I want people to understand, when I talk to Patrick Pizzella, this represents why you want to join the Job Creators Network. He is working Congress on your behalf, small business, but he can't know what you need until you join and tell Job Creators Network, so go to joinjcn.com. So, Patrick, the PRO Act came out of the House. It's not got nothing to do with the NFL draft this week. It's sort of just be called the Anti-Small Business Act. What's in the PRO Act?
Well, the PRO Act has so many negatives, it actually should be called the CON Act.
Yep.
it would violate the fundamental rights of free speech, employee privacy, and secret ballot elections. It eliminates the right-to-work laws now on the books in 27 states. And it would outlaw millions of small businesses that are independent contractors. It's just not anti-business. It's anti-worker also.
Hey, Patrick, now, I think you're a Pennsylvania native. Am I right about that?
New York native.
Okay, that's better. Then you'll know that we have to slow down for the Steelers fans. They don't know what a right-to-work statute is. Can you explain to them what it is so that why we want to keep those in place and not cripple the 27 states that have them?
Sure. In 1947, the Taft-Hartley Act authorized states to adopt right-to-work laws which prohibit workers from being forced to pay dues to a union in order to keep their job. Since that time, 27 states have adopted such laws, and workers are free to join a union or not to join a union. The states that don't have right-to-work laws, unions can coerce employees into paying dues.
Now, Patrick, you're actually talking to a union member. I've been a member of SAG-AFTRA for 30-something years, and I love SAG-AFTRA. They send me free DVDs. I'm not anti-union. I'm anti-stupid, and I'm anti-coercion, so I'm anti the PRO Act. Why did marginal district Democrats vote for this? I mean, people are going to get wiped out for this because nobody in America, look at the Amazon vote in Alabama. Nobody likes private sector unions, and they really loathe public sector unions.
Well, let me put that in perspective for your listeners. In 1955, the AFL and the CIO merged, and they had 16 million members at that time, all in the private sector. Fast forward to 2020. The number of private sector union members is 7.1 million. It's down 44%. And that's what's driving this, is that union officials want the government to provide them more power in order to increase their membership without having to actually sell the idea of joining a member to an individual employee.
Because they don't have a value proposition, Patrick. I know a lot of union people out there. SAG-AFTRA has a value proposition for me. Good health care. So I've always liked it. If I ever needed it, I could get it. And they got a retirement. They've got a defined benefit plan. So SAG-AFTRA is old school, and I kind of like it. There is no value benefit proposition now that is persuasive in the private sector. Public sector, a different argument. But if they make the PRO Act go in the Senate, everybody's screwed.
Yeah, it would put an enormous amount of additional power in the hands of union officials. And as you just alluded to, the most recent test of which even the president of the United States weighed in was the Amazon election that was held in Alabama. And there the workers made a clear-cut decision. Over 70% of them said, no, we don't want representation by a union. We're fine as we are.
Now, Patrick, you've joined JCN, which is what I want every small business in America to do. Go to joinjcn.com. Why did you do that? You could have done anything you wanted right now. You know everything about labor and Fair Labor Commission. Why would you do this?
Well, JCN has an excellent reputation, and the issues that are on the table that are going to affect small businesses and economic growth in general are the issues that they're willing to engage in. And I thought it was a terrific opportunity to be with such a solid organization and help to spread, shall we say, the joys of capitalism.
Oh, it is at the intersection of expertise and opportunity that Patrick Pezzella joined JCN. You should as well, America. Go to joinjcn.com. Forget the chamber in D.C. It's melted down. Join the Job Creators Network. Joinjcn.com. Come right back.
Well, love is blind and you're far too kind. Don't ever let it show. I wish that I knew what I know now. When I was younger, I wish that I knew what I know now. When I was stronger.
Welcome back, America. Hugh Hewitt, joined by United States Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas. Good morning, Senator. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. It's good to be on with you, as always.
I have you ever been on the Gallagher show, Senator? Are you considered too young for that demo?
I've heard you this morning, Hugh. Apparently, unless you're part of the silent generation, born in the 1920s and 30s, you're too young for that demo.
Well, I'm just telling you, he's got this new line of walkers out, and I just want to recommend it. If either of your parents or your grandparents just need a walker, the Gallagher walker is really something. I got to tell you, you're in the news this morning. You may not even know it because it's in the Daily Mail in the United Kingdom. And you got to be aware, there's a warrant out for your arrest for newspaper homicide. You are being credited with killing the New York Times op-ed. It says here that in your June 2020 op-ed, sent in the troops, led to a series of events that culminated yesterday in the announcement that the op-ed is dead at the New York Times. They will now be called guest editorials. And your fingerprints are all over this chain of proximate cause.
Hugh, I did see that news. Daily Mail is a great news source to wake up to in the morning. So they're a few hours ahead of us. And I have to say, I don't regret killing off a 50-year tradition at the New York Times. I can only say this kind of hasty, rash decision would not have been made back when I owned the New York Times last summer.
It was a brief but wonderful time in the life span of the newspaper. But the after effects, the aftershocks of your brief tenure in charge of the New York Times have been enduring, and the paper may never recover. All right, Senator, let's get serious. I got the story of the day is on the census, and I am worried by this because for the second slowest rate since the government started counting in 1790 as our population increased. The 1930s, we had a bad decade. We just had a terrible decade. We need people to have babies, and we need immigration reform, and you are one of the proponents of immigration reform. On the positive side of the ledger, we all know what a nightmare the southern border is, and we can talk about that later. What is the Cotton plan for getting immigration right?
So, Hugh, a few years back, I introduced my RAISE Act, and that's focused solely on our green card system, which is the way we create new citizens. To me, the most important part of our immigration system. It's certainly important that we secure our border and we enforce our immigration laws. We need a careful review of those non-immigrant visas that guest workers get and whether they're needed in our economy in different sectors. But the most important thing any immigration system can view as naturalized new American citizens. And right now, our green card system is completely divorced from the needs and the economic realities of our country. Only about one out of 14 green cards of the million-plus green cards that we give out a year is remotely tied to genuine economic need. Most of them are given away to family members. They're given away to winners of the diversity lottery. There's crazy quotas and set-asides where we clearly don't have needs, like several thousand a year for lawyers. I think most Americans would agree the last thing we need is to bring more lawyers into our country.
I will agree with that 100%. Yeah.
So what my system would do, Hugh, modeled somewhat on the Canadian system, the Australian system, which are often held up as the best models in the world, would be very simple, very straightforward. It assigned a certain number of points to foreigners who want to immigrate to our country based on their age. Younger is better, so they have more time to make a life here, more time to make money, more time to pay taxes into our system. Education in practical fields like science and technology and engineering gets the most points. English language skills gets more points. There's points awarded for any kind of exceptional skill. Say you're an Olympic athlete or you're a Nobel Prize winner or you win other prestigious prizes from around the world. And then it would just award those points and give the highest number of points getters every 6 months the green cards. So it would transform us from a very backward immigration system that looks towards what's happened over the last, say, four decades, and looks instead towards what we need over the next four decades to help grow our economy.
Now, I can't stress this enough. I talked with Byron York earlier in the show, and Byron said, look, green cards have been holding steady. We give out about a million a year for 40 years or 50 years. My theory, if you give out the right ones, you should be giving out double and triple that. We can't compete with India and China in an age where artificial intelligence depends upon data sets and economic skills that are not in great supply here, including computer technology, engineering, STEM skills, with two countries with 1.3 billion people. We will get wiped out. We need to get people here. And what is the reception your immigration plan has received on both sides of the aisle?
Well, Hugh, it's right that we need the right skill mix here. And we know that's the people who come here and train here and work here to actually become citizens in the long run. You hear a lot about guest worker visas, things like the H-1B worker visa or H-2 or the J-1 or so forth. Remember, there's a word left out of all those terms. Those are non-immigrant visas, which means those people are not going to make a life here. We should not be training the world's best and brightest if they don't want to come here and stay here. That's why I've got legislation, for instance, that would exclude any Chinese national from doctorate or postdoc study at national laboratories in sensitive fields if they're not going to immigrate here and be a full-time citizen for the rest of their lives here. We don't want them going back to China and helping the PLA and the CCP in all those fields. That's why we need a system that looks to the future and our economic needs. Now, this system itself actually gets a lot of support from both Republicans and Democrats. The issue becomes when Democrats think that they need to get something in return that is obviously a deal breaker, like a massive amnesty or a refusal to enforce our immigration laws either at the border or at the workforce. So if we could just focus on this most important part of our immigration system, which is our naturalization process for creating new citizens, I think we would be able to find bipartisan support.
Now, Senator Cotton, because we probably have some daylight between us here, because I think it's so important to get this right and get the right people here in enough numbers to keep the country productive, competitive, and in first place and exceptional. I would like a commission, and I had President Bush on last week, and I wouldn't mind if he and Clinton got together and brought you in and brought a couple of people in from left and right, and y'all sat down and reasoned together, and it's Kissinger rule. The more issues you put on the table, the more likely you are to get a deal because everyone gets something. Is there not a comprehensive deal out there that, I mean, not one, God love Lindsey Graham, but I don't want a gang of 20 or a gang of 30 or a gang of 10. You guys always screw it up because the same staff makes the same mistakes. Is there not a solution that's comprehensive to get more people here and to secure the border and to take care of the people who are, they need to be regularized. I don't like the word amnesty because I don't believe in citizenship for these folks for 20 or 30 years. But is there not a deal to be had to get an overhaul that we desperately need? The census underscores it. We desperately need an overhaul.
Well, Hugh, I have to say this is one place where I'm not sure that Dr. Kissinger's dictum applies, and that's in part because those of us who believe in securing our borders and enforcing our immigration laws, believe in national sovereignty, believe that we have to have an immigration system that serves the interest of Americans, not foremost the interest of foreigners, have seen the rug pulled out from underneath us too many times over the years. The best example of this is the 1986 immigration legislation. It had an immediate amnesty, it had enforcement money, and it had other legal reforms. The amnesty happened, and that's irreversible. Once an amnesty happens and people become citizens or even become green card holders, that cannot be reversed. However, the enforcement didn't really happen. Future Congresses defunded it. The bureaucracy slow rolled it. Advocacy groups on both sides, like the ACLU and the chamber, went to court to enjoin it. That's why we ended up with another 15 or 20 million illegal aliens in the country since 1986. So people who want to control immigration and have an immigration system that works in the best interest of Americans first don't want to play Charlie to the open borders crown Lucy once again with her pulling the football away. That's why it's so important as a precondition that you finish along the southern border and you reform our asylum laws so we don't see the chaos that we have at the southern border now, and you provide immigration and custom enforcement the tools they need to crack down on illegal immigration inside the country. And that includes you. That very much includes you cracking down on unscrupulous employers who are using illegal labor, oftentimes exporting illegal labor, to the detriment of American workers.
That is all clearly doable. This is what I say in response. Yes, 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 and yes. We don't have to do Charlie and Brown in the football. We don't have to let Lucy do it. You can write a law that makes everything contingent on the completion of the wall, and I mean 900 miles. I don't mean what we've got. I mean where we need it. And you can rewrite the asylum rules so that we do not have all alien free asylum, and that can all be done, and the carrot can be big enough and the stick's powerful enough to get it done if we do it outside of Congress. I really don't think your staff, not your, not the Cotton staff, but I don't think Congress as an institution is capable of shaking off the cobwebs on this stuff, Senator. Do you?
If you set a low bar for Congress, you should never be surprised when Congress still falls low underneath it. But the one thing that Congress does have is political accountability, Hugh, at the ballot box. And especially in the Republican Party, Republican leaders were too long divorced from what Republican voters wanted. You had too many people who basically had an open borders mindset leading the Republican Party for 30 years. The idea that we needed ever more immigration to include not just immigrants, but we needed more of those non-immigrant visas. And we could kind of make some general feints or gestures towards enforcement, but largely turned a blind eye to the illegal immigration that continued. So Republican voters, again, feel pretty weary of buying into the kind of deal that has been proposed over and over again over the last three or four decades.
I agree. The resistance to it has built up dramatically. And I told one of your colleagues at the last effort to have a gang of something or other called me up and asked me why I was opposed. I said, you guys always screw it up. You don't have in a wall. You don't even, I used to call it a double-sided, long, strong fencing. And they added some, you know, nonsense words. I almost used a bad word there. And it didn't work. And, of course, I shot at it, as did every other person, because most people have common sense about it. I just don't think there's any common sense in Congress. Now, they'd have to validate whatever a commission came up with. But if they tried, would you at least read what they came up with at the end before you said yay or nay?
Oh, sure. I mean, I would listen to the thoughts of any well-informed, serious, and sober analysis about ways to improve our immigration system, or for that matter, ways to improve anything that the Congress does. But one thing that we've seen in recent years is that Republican voters feel a little burned by even Republican leaders, say nothing of Democrats. And on this one, Republican voters are definitely right.
Yeah, well, your buddy Mike Pompeo says about China, not trust but verify, but distrust and verify. And I believe what you're saying about immigration is how I feel about commissions and proposals. Don't trust and verify, but distrust whatever comes out and verify it. But nevertheless, give it a shot. Give it a shot. Senator Tom Cotton, good luck in getting on the Gallagher Show. You're way too young to be a guest on the Gallagher Show, but we hope that he'll let you on sometime to talk immigration. Tom Cotton from Arkansas, America. Follow him at Sen Tom Cotton on Twitter. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, joined by Hotline Josh on Twitter, Josh Crash Hour, columnist for the National Journal. Good morning, Josh. How are you?
Good morning, Hugh. Good to be back.
Are you draft week ready?
You know, I am. You know, the big question here in Washington is whether the football team is going to get a new quarterback. But, you know, I'm not as hyped up about the draft as a lot of other people, just because we have a history of just striking out on our first round picks. So we'll see what happens.
The best unreported story for a Clevelander and everyone in Ohio is that the Ted Lasso promo made fun of the Jets and not the Browns. And so that is like a breakthrough moment for us. Josh, I want to talk to you about a couple of your tweets. People did not notice. You noticed that the Iranian foreign minister made a note that in his tapes that have been leaked, that the Trump decision to take out Soleimani did more damage to Iran than destroying an entire city. Why did that not get? I think it got my proposition. It did not get widely reported because it credits Trump. Why do you think it was not widely reported?
Well, I think these days partisanship dictates so much of coverage. So I think that's part of it. Look, and I also think you have the White House isn't trying. I mean, usually you would think that Republicans and Democrats would be on the same page. They'd be trying to counter Iran's malign influence in the region. But, you know, this is true of the Obama administration. I think it's true with the same foreign policy officials in the Biden administration. This goal of just having an agreement, having a nuclear deal for the sake of a nuclear deal is driving a lot of the foreign policy. And the Obama foreign policy folks were critical of taking out Soleimani because they thought it would, among other reasons, jeopardize Obama's legacy of the Iran nuclear deal. And the Biden administration seems to be wary about, you know, doing anything, you know, whether it's Israel sabotage of Iran's nuclear facilities or whether it's just looking back at what happened in the Trump administration. They don't want to do anything that would jeopardize cutting a deal for the sake of cutting a deal. I know a lot of our allies in the region, namely Israel, are worried that, you know, the deal could actually end up empowering Iran and end up relieving them of these powerful sanctions. And the agreement itself won't do a whole lot to constrain their nuclear ambition. So sometimes I'm just sort of amazed that, like, when you have Israel that's actually really taking a hit to one of the Iran nuclear facilities and really doing what we should want, and you don't hear a lot of American, a lot of the Biden administration cheering that on, it makes you wonder what exactly the end goal is for the foreign policy.
The same negative energy towards Israel that existed throughout the Obama years is back. Now, the Zarif tapes matter a lot because they matter a lot. I have published today at my podcast interview with Hugh Hewitt, my Kerry interview from September of 18, in which he admitted to meeting with Zarif. I wanted people to be able to hear it for themselves. Is he in trouble? I don't think he's in trouble. I actually think he's sort of the de facto president because the president is occasionally absent from the stage for so long. Kerry fills the vacuum. A, is Kerry in trouble? B, do you agree with my assessment about the senior guy in the room is always John Kerry?
No, he's not in trouble. There are a lot. I mean, it's actually pretty striking that you're not just seeing the usual suspects of Republican lawmakers calling for Kerry to step down. Mike Gallagher, who is a pretty mainstream, pretty pragmatic Republican congressman in Wisconsin, said the same thing last night. You're hearing sort of a growing chorus of Republican officials, but it's a partisan issue right now, and certainly there are no Democrats that would support that. I think there's also more facts that need to be known. Kerry said that this is untrue, what was alleged in these tapes where Zarif was talking. It's possible that we don't know if he was disclosing things that were not public information at the time. We don't know exactly when this tape was recorded. So we still need to get more facts about what exactly Zarif was talking about and what the time frame was before there's any kind of, you know, political accountability.
And Josh, you're one of the few people to have noted the most important part of the census story yesterday is that U.S. population grew at the slowest rate since the 1930s and at the second slowest rate in the history of the census back to 1790. I just talked to Tom Cotton about this. I've been banging on this drum all day. The United States needs more people. We cannot do this with 330 million people. We are missing 50 million people because of abortion. We need more people in the United States. Is that widely shared in the halls of Congress? Do they understand when you're up against India and China, combined population 2.6 billion, 330 million in the age of AI does not make it?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if that's being talked about. I don't think it's actually the leading thought in the halls of Congress. But it's a problem. I mean, that's pretty remarkable, Hugh, that we've had our slowest population growth, second slowest population growth since the founding of the country. I mean, that is, you see the consequences of low fertility rates, of low growth in Europe, and in how their societies are facing a lot of political challenges. We escaped a lot of those challenges in the last couple of decades, but now it looks like this Europeanization of you know, this trend of what happened in Europe is certainly affecting us. And if we don't, you know, it's sort of a double whammy. You know, the fertility rate is dropped off the face of the earth. I think the pandemic over the last year is only going to accelerate that challenge. And also immigration is also way down, according to the census figures, and there's less new people. I mean, part of the United States' historical appeal is getting new people to come to this country, build a new generation of Americans. That has been slowing down as well. So,
Tom Cotton, I just talked about it. Number one, we got to sell people on the joys of children, and they really are joyful to have. But two, we have to open up the gates and bring in people who want to be Americans, as Tom Cotton just said, who want to live the American dream. Josh Kroshauer, as always, a pleasure. Follow him at Twitter at Hotline Josh. Thank you, Harley and Ben. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, Generalissimo. Thank you, Mike Gallagher. We love you. We really do. I'll be back tomorrow on the next Hugh Hewitt Show.